Okay, remember that a monk will always have lust, and a nun as well, when they don't have any happiness in their meditation. That is natural. So it is important as a bhikkhu to develop your meditation. When the meditation is peaceful and happy, you're not interested in a lower form of happiness, of lust. But if your meditation does not develop and you don't have happiness sitting alone, then the mind will start thinking about lustful things. It is the peace and joy of meditation which is the most important thing to overcome lust. And many of you know that the pleasures of lust are very, very problematical. In particular, the Buddha described Kama Chanda as being in debt, taking out a loan. So if you, for example, you're meditating and have a sexual fantasy, you have happiness for the time you're enjoying the fantasy, but you have to pay it back afterwards with interest. In other words, you get more suffering than the happiness you had during the time you had the fantasy. So if you really want to have happiness, don't go into debt with sexual fantasies or thoughts. See if you can restrain the mind. See the dangers in sexual fantasies. See the dangers in lust. Understand those dangers. And understand the escape, from lust. In other words, if you do see something which is attractive, look for that which is not attractive in that person. Anything. I said I always look at the pimples, or try and see if I can catch a smell of their armpits. Anything which is disgusting. And if you can do that, you find your balance. It's not a perfect person. It takes away the fantasy. If you have another fantasy about romance, thinking you can disrobe and have a beautiful life with a beautiful woman, please remember that you are not special. You are not different than every other person who has a relationship with a girl. You have a lot of suffering. You know, if you've read those books of mine, there are three rings of marriage. The engagement ring is number one. The wedding ring is number two. The suffer ring is number three. Don't be stupid, but sometimes a monk feels you are special. Other people have bad relationships, but you think you can do it differently. And you cannot. You'll have the same suffering. So don't think that you can get this beautiful relationship, find a partner in life and live happily ever after. It does not happen. So you now are bhikkhus, bhikkhunis. You have this great opportunity to free yourself from the suffering which always comes from lust. You have the opportunity. Don't waste it. The path of meditation is open for you. You have great support in a country like Sri Lanka. There are many places you can go for solitude. Stay in solitude. I have given many teachings today, and many more teachings you can find on the internet, on your smartphones or tablets, whatever you have. But even more important than that, even just the short sessions we've had today, I have brainwashed you. Surprising, you may think, no, I have not, but I have. Because when I used to listen to Ajahn Chah, some of the stuff he said I either did not understand or I didn't believe. I thought he was crazy. And later on, even when I was in Australia, I'd be meditating, come across a problem, and I see the solution. And afterwards, where did that idea come from? And I would see, I could remember it from a talk Ajahn Chah gave years ago, 20 years ago. all this Dhamma, the really important stuff, it sticks in your mind somewhere, ready for the time you need it. One such simile, which is one of my teacher's greatest, and it's the one I told, I think, in BMICH, I was in Thailand, this is 39 years ago now, he said his monastery was a mango orchard, with the trees planted by the Buddha himself. And that those trees are full, 2,500 years later, full of ripe, juicy, sweet mangoes. And he said, because of the Buddha's wisdom and compassion, monks, nuns, upasakas, upasikas, do not need to shake the tree to get a mango to fall. You don't need to climb the tree to get a mango. You don't need to throw a stick up to get the mango to fall. All you need to do, in fact the only way you can get a mango to fall, is to sit perfectly still under the mango tree, hold out your hand, and a mango will fall into it. That was his simile. And of course, I did not understand that. Until years later, I realized how important stillness was. Not to do meditation, not to chase things, but to let go so much I became perfectly still, not to strive. That just made me agitated. To become perfectly still, open up my heart with compassion, and all these incredible things just fell into my heart. And I realized afterwards, what I never understood before, my teacher understood. He tried to teach it to me. I could not understand. I was not ready, but I remembered it. There's something about Dhamma which is very powerful. You can't forget it. It stays there. And later on, you will understand, like I did, how powerful such a teaching was. Be perfectly still. That is the goal of meditation. Jhanas, paths and fruits, they just fall into you. You don't go chasing them. You don't do vipassana, that's shaking the tree. That's climbing up it, throwing things up, trying to get vipassana. You don't do anything, you sit perfectly still. Open up your heart with compassion. And paths and fruits, insights, they just come to you. And that is, once that happens to you, will understand, just... Now that Ajahn Chah he knew what he was talking about, because that's how it works. You may not believe it, you may not do it now, this year or next year, but one day you will, and you realize what a great teaching that is. So what I've taught you, I don't expect you to agree with it. I don't even expect you to understand it. I expect it to be in there, ready for the time. Your stillness is so great that you can take it deeper into jhanas. And then all these things happen. And then you come again out after and say, wow, yes, how it works. Because it does. So that's why I teach. Not expecting people to understand. But to put the seeds inside of you. Waiting for the rain to come and fertilize them. Usually that is natural. That is just the nature of sight. Only the nimittas come up when you're very still. The nimitta, the appearance of the citta, only arises when the five senses are suppressed. Imagine you've got your five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and you've got the sixth sense, the mind. Human beings are so caught up with the five senses. The five senses are so strong and powerful, you can't see that sixth sense. As you suppress, calm down the five senses, as you give more power to the sixth sense, the mind, there comes a point where the mind becomes stronger, more powerful than the five senses. And that's when nimittas start to arise. Again, the five senses haven't fully disappeared yet. They fully disappear in jhanas, not in nimitta stages. The five senses have been so calmed down, it gives the nimitta, the citta, a chance to appear. If your nimitta or your citta is very strong, then it can appear very early when the five senses, you know, are still pretty easy to see and to experience. And that is why that if you get into jhanas and develop these a lot, sometimes you will have the experience, you may be eating your lunch, and you have your bowl of food and there's a huge nimitta right in front of you while you're eating, and you have to sort of almost eat through the nimitta. Because the nimitta is always there. It's so powerful, so strong, that even when the other five senses are active, the nimitta is right there. That's only when you have very powerful meditations. But those little dots you see, that's just the nature of sight. It's not real nimittas at all. The real nimittas come when the five senses are very, very soft, and the mind, the sixth sense, is very powerful. Obviously, the more you calm down the five senses, the easier it is to see the sixth sense. Which is why many of you will have to really suppress the five senses. So you can't feel the body, you can't hear sounds, no smells, taste, touch. And then the nimitta is very easy to see. You are just experiencing the sixth sense. And you can't do that unless the other five senses are very, very soft. Basically, they've just almost disappeared. There's not enough time. And you have all that time to meditate when you leave. I want to make, you know, my wisdom, my knowledge available to you as much as possible. You can meditate without me, but you can't hear my talk without me.
It's a blessing to meditate with you too.
Yeah, I know, but we're doing this for talking. You can meditate many times, and as I mentioned to you, you can get these little machines and you can get guided meditations, all sorts of stuff on these machines. You can get any mic in the world to meditate in solitude with you. You're not feeling it with the body, you're knowing it with the mind. There's so many different types of sukha. So when the ordinary piti sukha vanishes, it's called equanimity. But that is sukha. Happiness has so many different flavors. When happiness disappears, that is even more happiness. That is why I think it was Udayin, who was it, who asked Sariputta, how can Nibbana be the highest happiness when there's nothing felt or perceived in Nibbana? When it's Sanyavediyata Nirodha, the cessation of all that's felt and experienced, how can you call that happiness? And that's where Sariputta said, using the simile, when you are sick in hospital and the sickness disappears, that's happiness when the sickness disappears. It's the end of an affliction. And he said in the first jhana, that's happiness because the body and the five senses have disappeared. It's the end of an affliction, like you're not sick anymore, the sickness is gone. Ah, I feel happy. The body is not here anymore, I feel happy. The second jhana is more happy than the first because it's an end of an affliction, the vitaka vichara. The third jhana, the end of an affliction, of pity. The fourth jhana, the end of an affliction, sukha, that's even more sukha. And then the arupas, all these ending of an afflictions. And the nirodha samapatti. Just to experience, to perceive, to know, Vedana and Sanya is an affliction. Now, it's a kanda, it's dukkha. So when those disappear, you can say that is happiness, even though that nothing is felt or perceived. And that's a very beautiful description by the great Sariputta. So, when sukha disappears and you enter fourth jhana, it's the end of an affliction. That's why you can call it sukha. There is no such thing as lokiya and lokutra jhana. All jhana is uttari manusa dhamma. That error comes, I'm not quite sure how people miss this. If you look at, I think it's at Shatavisa Sutta, the Great 40, whatever it's called. There the Buddha distinguishes samadhiti as Lokuttara samadhiti and samadhiti with like karma results. He makes the same distinction between samasankappa, samma vaja, samma kammanto, and samma ajivo. And there the distinction stops. It only applies to the first five factors of the Eightfold Path. Have a look at that. I noticed that when I first watched it. I first looked at that sutra, Mahacatavasaka Sutta. If you actually see that there, it only applies that no distinction between Lokiya and Lokuttara to the first five factors. When it comes to Vayama, there's no such distinction. It's all Lokuttara. There is no Lokiya Sati and Lokuttara Sati. It's all Lokuttara and Samasati. As with Samasamadhi, it's always Lokuttara. There is no such thing in the sutras. And that is one of the reasons why that people don't read the suttas, they misrepresent them, and they make it that some jhanas are Lokiya. They are not. They're all Lokuttara. They're all Uttari Manusa Dhamma. He did have the jhanas, but as soon as he had conceit, he lost all his ability to attain those jhanas. So yes, he had the jhanas. He did not turn them into insight because of his conceit and pride. He could not really see sort of anatta because he took them after he emerged as personal possessions, attainments. That's why he went to go and show off to Devadatta. So to Ajatasattu by appearing as a snake on his lap. So Devadatta, he had the jhanas because of conceit. He lost that ability. But not, they're all Lokuttara. Yes, it would have been. He did not use properly because you need the panya and the jhana. Nati jhanang apanyasa, panya nati ajayato, yamhi jhanang chapanya chasa, way nibbana santike. He would have been close to it, but the panya was too weak, so he could not get the nibbana. And why was the panya weak? Again, because the years of competing with his cousin the Buddha. So much conceit there. And that's what stopped him. And as soon as you have that conceit, you lose your jhanas, which is one of the problems. If you start off and you think these jhanas are attainments, and they just add to your conceit, and you think you're enlightened, you have big trouble. Many monks even now have that trouble. So be careful. These are not states of which you attain. If you look carefully, these are states when you disappear, you vanish. You should never take them as personal attainments. Then what happens when your idea of self vanish? But they're all, look at the Vinaya, all jhanas are called Uttari Manusa Dhamma. Which is why if you claim a jhana and you haven't got one, you know you're lying, that is Parajika. That's one of the reasons why lay people can say all sorts of things about jhanas. But you monks, be very careful. Don't say, don't even tell other people. Tell your teacher, okay, but don't tell others. And certainly go and say, I got jhanas, lay people, look at me, I've got jhanas. It's dangerous and it could be a parajika for you. So because of that, it is Uttari Manusa Dhamma. That's Lokuttara. Uttari Lokuttara. It can't be Lokiya. And look, if you ever get a jhana, you know, just, to me that was offensive. When people started saying, Lokiya jhanas? You've never achieved a jhana. If you've achieved a jhana in your life, you would never ever call it Lokiya of the world. It's totally out of this world. This world is Kama Loka. Jhanas are Rupa Loka. They are literally out of this world. Out of Kama Loka. So they're not Lokiya at all. They are out of this world, Lokuttara. They are Uttari Manusa Dhamma. So that really is quite offensive to anyone who's achieved a jhana or knows a jhana. To call them Loki, you don't know what you're talking about. But that's one of the reasons why it puts jhana down. As I said earlier, it's one way where you don't respect samadhi. It's one of the causes for the decline of the sasana. If you are one who is still open to being influenced by those sights and sounds, keep your eyes cast down when you go on Bindabhata. Don't look at the person giving you alms. Look on your bowl, which is what you're supposed to do by the sakyas. You're not supposed to look at the person. Look at your bowl. And then when you receive alms like that, you go through the village, all you see is your bowl, the food coming up in it. You don't even know who offered it to you. I train like that. And I remember when I was staying in a monastery in Thailand and we went on alms round, and when we came back, the abbot said, "Oh, did you see that Western girl who gave you alms food?" Because it was very rare to see a Western girl. I think she was working for the Peace Corps. And I said, "I never saw any girl." And it was actually true. I was very actually quite pleased with myself for that. And the abbot said, "Well done." Because I didn't see her. I just was just washing my bowl all the time. I never saw the girl. Now that is how you should practice. So it could be some film star. I mean, Angelina Jolie is in line waiting to offer food. I did say actually Rafael Nadal, there's a picture of him, the tennis star, offered food to monks in Thailand. And, you know, you go walking arms around and people say, "Did you see that was the tennis star, Rafael Nadal, he offered you food?" All I saw was food go in the bowl. I never saw who it came from. Then you're a monk. That's how you sort of sense restraint. You don't have to look. You don't have to listen. It's just you can focus as you're walking. And of course, you know our tradition is when you are walking for alms food, you're supposed to be developing loving kindness, metta for all those people who offer you food. May they all be happy and well. They're sacrificing so much, you know, so I can live in solitude. And you know, you live in places where villagers, really poor villagers, they offer you food. Don't look at them. Just develop maitri. And then you don't have this lust and stuff. And if you do have lust for a girl, look at her mother. She's going to turn into that much quicker than you expect. So do you want to marry that? So if the sama samadhi is based on michaditti, yeah, no, jhana is jhana is jhana. Where it comes from, it doesn't really matter. And if you fluke one, like a Christian, they've got michaditti, but they manage, at least two of them manage to get into jhanas. So it's based on michaditti, but it's still jhanas. This is when they come out, they can't really sort of take the view, the panya, put it together with the jhana and make it into enlightenment. Again, you can never take a sutra and look at it in isolation without looking at all the other sutras. You know, you have in the, I forget with this Chula, I think it's Chula Vedala, not the Maha Vedala, what is the cause for the arising of samadhiti? And there are two causes, the Yoni Samanisikara and the Paratagosa, the two causes for the arising. And I always wondered, Yoni Samanasikara, what does that really mean? It's usually in English said, you know, wise attention. But usually, you know, you can analyze that word. Manasikara is literally the work of the mind. And Yonisa, you know the word Yoni? It's womb, source. It goes to the source of things. The mind which goes into the source, which goes into this moment, which goes into the silence, which goes into the breath, which goes into the nimitta, which goes into the jhanas. I interpret, you may argue with me, but there is a good justification of interpreting Yoniso Manasikara in this context as the mind going into its center, the jhanas. And the Paratagosa, you know that there is one person, some stupid Westerner, who said Paratagosa means the word of God. He said that. Or some other being. No, because you know that Paraloka, not this world, the other world, So they interpret it as the word of some other divine being, the word of God speaking to you. Absolutely crazy stuff. It means the word of another. You put that together with other sutras, and it has to be the word of an Aryan. Those are the two things which come together, the jhana and the panya. Those two need to come together. So again, those two Christians probably had jhana, but they didn't have panya. So yeah, they had jhana, no panya, so they weren't really in the presence of nibbana. It is basically they're describing the same parts of the process. Water has vanished when the tadpole becomes a frog and jumps out to the lake. Anicca does not mean rise and fall, it means things have vanished, they're gone. Viraga means fading away. I know that many people call it dispassion, but it has that second meaning, which is the one which applies in that context. Now the water has faded away. Nirodha, it's ceased. It's gone. Finished. And Patinissaka, it's basically been thrown away. Different ways of saying, describing the same event. So that is why any one of those would work. It's just like people say that, you can become enlightened by focusing on anicca or dukkha or anatta. Any one of those works. But once you see one, you'll always see the other two. But you focus on one. Say you focus on dukkha. You know, it's the five senses are dukkha because when they vanish, you're happy. You're focusing on dukkha, but you can only see that when things vanish, when the water vanishes. You know it's anatta because if it vanishes, it can't be my permanent, always there self. Because it's not there now. Where have I gone? So any one of these can work. You see one, you have to see the other two. You focus on one of those four things after the 13, 14, 15, 16 stages of Anapanasati, the other ones work. It's the same as the first two stages of Anapanasati, breathing in long or breathing in short. You don't need to breathe in long first of all, deliberately, and then breathe in short deliberately. Okay, I've done that now. All it really means is, you know whether you're breathing in long, breathing in short. A lot of the time it's in the middle. Does that mean I'm breathing in neither long nor short, but average? Does that mean you're not doing Anapanasati? All that really means is either one will do, or in the middle. It just gives you a help in being able to focus on the breath, making it interesting. Is my breath long or is my breath short? It makes it more interesting before you can don't worry whether it's long or short and you just watch the breath. What it is that for the Putu Channa, it's usually Sila first and then Samadhi and then Sampanya. For the Putu Channa, you can go the other way around. You can start doing some meditation first, like many people do in the West. And then they find out that Sila is important. So for the Putu Channa, you can do it any which way. But when you become an Arya, the first thing which is perfected is Samaditti. So that sequence where Samaditti gives rise to Sammasankappa is a sequence for an Aryan, for a stream winner, going all the way to actually Anagami. And after Anagami, I think that's where Sammasamadhi is perfected. So that, from Samaditti, you got the right view, then you'll perfect your Sammasankappa. You won't have intentions of lust anymore. And then, because you won't have intentions of lust, basically, or ill will, you're an Anagami. And you have right speech, right action, right livelihood, obviously. The effort is, you don't have unwholesome states coming up. So the effort is purified. And you have sati, and you purify Sammasamadhi. The purification of Sammasamadhi, I think in the Anguttara Nikaya, is defined as being the Anagami. You've purified it, you've completed it, fulfilled, paripuna. And then after Sammasamadhi, Samanyana, Samavimutti, I think. And that's from Anagami to being an Arahat. So this is actually where in that particular sutta, Sammaditti leading to these other things. That's actually showing the process, which is going to happen quite naturally, but may take a while, from being a stream winner, the fruit of stream winning, to the fruit of anagami. There is no such word as access concentration in the sutras. You look at upachara samadhi, just does not exist. Nevertheless, I agree that, you know, that you can say that. You know, that there is such a thing as upachara samadhi just before jhanas and also just after jhanas. You go into the threshold before you enter a door and also when you go out of the door. There are always two upacharas, before jhana and after jhana. And the point is that the upachara after jhana, the threshold concentration, that is the place where you get enlightened, not as you go in. Because as you go in, number one, you don't really know that you're at the threshold of jhanas until you can go in. When you come out, you're at that threshold for a long period of time. As you go in, it's very unstable. As you come out, five hindrances have gone for a long time. That upachara is there for a long time. That's why people become enlightened not on the way into jhanas, but on the way out. So even though upachara samadhi doesn't exist in the sutras, I think it's valid because I can see that. If you look at it, the five hindrances aren't there for a long period of time. It's one of the reasons why if a person has a strong jhana, they think they can be enlightened. They think they are enlightened. I mentioned my story when I first thought I was enlightened in my book. You know, the story of, you know, when they had the rotten fish curry mixed up with the pork curry. I'll let you read that in the book. But I really thought I was enlightened. It lasted for maybe about 10 hours. Wonderful feeling to think you're enlightened. But really just very disappointed when you find you're not. And it was because of power samadhi. No hindrances at all. No desires, no sloth and torpor, middle of the night, you just can meditate, absolutely so easy. Just watch the breath and just stays with you, nimittas, everything. So simple when you've got no defilements. But you know, it was just, I suppressed them, they hadn't totally got. I can see just how people think they're enlightened after such a point, because I thought I was. I thought it was a great arahat and a blessing for the world, and it's a wonderful feeling. Until it all falls apart, because I got angry at the senior monk. Because what happened, he had this terrible food, really disgusting, rotten fish curry. It stank. And even people in Bangkok don't like it. But this one day we had a pork curry as well as a rotten fish curry. When I saw that, we don't get that. It was months we haven't had pork curry. And I thought the heavenly beings were celebrating my attainment of arahat. That's what I thought. And I said, I'll get a good meal today. And then this abbot, you know, he's a local boy. He grew up on rotten fish curry. He should like it. He took about three or four really big ladles, I mean really big, no one can eat that, and put it in his bowl. And he didn't take any of the rotten fish curry. But I didn't mind, there's plenty left for me. And then what this, please excuse me, bastard of an abbot did, he took up this rotten fish curry and poured it right into the pork curry and stirred it all up, saying it's all the same, it's all the same. And I thought, if it was all the same, why didn't you mix it up before you took yours, you hypocrite? And you spoiled my lovely meal, you bastard abbot. And I was very angry at him for doing that. And then I suddenly realized, arahats don't think like that. Oh no! And that's when I realized I was not enlightened. And oh, that really hurt. And afterwards I didn't care what I ate after that. If you thought you were an arahat and you finally find out you weren't, you don't care what you eat. It spoils your whole day. Be careful, you get great meditation sometimes and you think you've done it. Because how you feel is how arahats do feel. No defilements at all, no lust, no anger. For hours, sometimes days, sometimes it works for years. Then suddenly something comes up. And you realize, oh no, I'm not. That's why the attainment of anagamin arahat, you have to wait for a long time before you can be so sure. Oh, sama samadhi is even first jhana qualifies as sama samadhi. Any of the jhanas are sama samadhi. One of the jhanas, two of the jhanas together, three jhanas, or having all the four jhanas, that's all qualifies as sama samadhi. Is it anagami? No, it's not. But when you purify those jhanas, in other words, that they're there for you anytime you want, then that will qualify you as anagami. That's one of the signs. But that's not an easy sign. The best easy sign of being an anagami is obviously no anger, no lust. Because if you're a stream winner, and you haven't attained anagami, but you're a jhana lover, even if you've got jhana many times, and you die, or you die within a jhana, which is much more difficult. It's hard to die within a jhana. That, you know, I think in the BMICH, that story of the monk, I think it's in the Sangyutta, who was cremated by the villagers while he was in jhana, and just survived and came out and walked in Ajahn the next day. There's another monk I knew had jhanas. I can say who he was now because he died a couple of years ago. Sudarmo, his name was. He was an Indonesian monk. And when I first met him in Wabuan, it's about 38 years ago, you know, straight away, you know, I had enough meditation. There was a powerful monk. I was with Venerable Menindo. And I said, who the heck is that? That guy's got some power. You could feel it. He said, yeah, because what he did, he was a layman, upasaka. He decided to be a hermit, a rishi, in Java. You know, when there was lots and lots of jungle in Java, there's hardly any left now. The population has, you know, expanded so much. He went into the jungle to actually become a rishi. He sat under a tree and he told me, he said he was getting very peaceful. This great star came to him and he merged into the star. Classic nimitta, classic jhanas. He said he didn't know how long he was there. But when he came out, he noticed the whole jungle had changed around him. He checked with the villagers. There had been a flash flood, a great storm, and he must have been under about 2 meters of water for days. You know, totally submerged. And of course, you know, didn't worry him at all. In the jhanas, you're perfectly safe. It seems you can't get killed. I don't know how that happens. So to die in a jhana is very, very difficult. I'm telling you this, one of the other princesses, a princess was supposed from Thailand, was supposed to come last night, another Mom Luang, who I knew really well. She was the one who used to go to Chelsea Art School, a real rebel, but, you know, the granddaughter of one of the kings of Thailand. She got interested in meditation from the Western monks. And she used to go to Wat Pho Wan in Bangkok to listen to this monk teach. And she told me, and I trust her. She said she was meditating, this monk was teaching, and she felt something really weird was happening. So she opened her eyes and she said, absolutely truthful, this monk, you could see rays of light coming out of him into another meditator. You know, like in the movies, like some superpower. You know, literally like flashlight rays coming out. You know, it's middle of the day, coming out of him into another monk. And she saw a nice, juicy psychic power, an iddhi. That monk had that stuff. But I say, you know, he can't die that way by being drowned. So it's very difficult. But if you do die, or if you have lots of jhanas, as a soul, and when you die, you get reborn in the jhana realms, in the rupa locus. Now, you know there's no self. And you've got such bliss, you are exactly the same as an anagami. You are in those jhanas, but when you pass away from the jhanas, you're nibbana, you don't go anywhere. That is your last life. It's called jhana anagami. And I know enough about this, that is absolutely 100% accurate. That's not something added, you know, into the sutras by something else. That's what works. So people who say, if you get jhanas and you get reborn into jhana realms, you'd be there for eons and you don't know anything, you have to come back and be reborn as a dog. No way. If you're a soul one and get into jhanas, the chances are if you get jhanas enough, you're going to be a soul one. I shouldn't say this, because if the Buddha was here, he'd really tell me off. That's a nice way out of samsara. Become a soul one, get jhanas. When you die, you go into the jhana realm, bliss for eons. And then when that bliss vanishes, that's it, you're gone. You go out with a bang. I like that. I saw that sutra as well. I thought, wow, yeah, I understand. That makes sense. The jhana anagami. You've got to get jhana first. Become a stream winner. You've got jhana, you've got a stream winner. That's what's going to happen to you. Any other questions? It's getting 5:30. I've got another one. How many more have you got there? How many more questions have you got? One of the problems with Goenka's tradition is that you go to Goenka's tradition, you're not allowed to go to another tradition. And if they hear that you've been practicing, you know, under Pao or you've been practicing under someone like me, you can't go back to Goenka. Things like that show me that there's something wrong when it's very cultish. I know they used to say the simile, well, you know, if you're digging a well, you can't dig a well over here and then over there and over there and think you're going to get anywhere. Dig the well in one place. Well, I counter that. If you're going to dig a well, sometimes you need a spade, sometimes you need a pick, sometimes you need many different tools to dig a well. Such as when you are meditating, you need many different tools, not just their tools. And of course, when there's no jhanas there, there is no insight. So you can't really get into someone that way. But I don't mind, because people in today's world, they do question. You know, you've been writing all these questions, and you will always question. And you will question Goenka method, question Pa'ok method, question every method. You question the Abhidharma, you question me. Carry on questioning, because that's what the Buddha encouraged. And they are questioning enough to think that that has many good qualities to it, Goenka, but not the full picture. So they'll start off with Goenka, as many people do. They get so far, they say, I need to go further. And they'll start doing jhanas. So it's not a bad thing. You know, it really makes many people meditate and gives people good sila. They go so far, and then they'll just carry on doing sort of the full Eightfold Path. Not a bad thing. But please always encourage people to question. Always argue. And please never be so respectful of a senior monk you will not argue with them. Even Mahanayakas argue. You argue with the Buddha, so surely you can argue with the Mahanayakas. The Kalama Sutta, of course. Well, in that great sutra, the Buddha was talking to Sariputta, I forget which one it was, and then Sariputta, do you believe this? Do you accept this? He said, no, I don't accept this at all, because I haven't experienced it. He said that right in front of his teacher and all his teacher's disciples. Do you agree with that, Sariputta? No, I don't, said Sariputta. They rejected his own teacher's advice. And he said, because I don't know, I haven't experienced that yet. And the Buddha said, that is why Sariputta is my wisest disciple. Now those examples you should follow. The problem with, one of the reasons why Buddhism in a place like Sri Lanka will become weak, is if you respect monks so much, you don't question them. Fortunately, we don't have that problem in Australia. Everybody, and they know absolutely nothing, argues with me. Ah, yeah, they can do that. They can press the letting go button. They can actually let go. But they haven't got the wisdom, the teaching of the Buddha to actually to turn that into enlightenment. It's just like the ascetics in the Christian church. There were two. Because the Christians, they always wrote books. And their descriptions, which you can read today, they indicate they probably did get the first jhana. But they never became enlightened. And I tell people, any Westerners here, it's such a shame you're not a Christian, because if you got jhana and you were a Christian, you'd become a saint. And they name universities and schools after you. You'd be Saint Nisarano. You'd be Saint Metawihari. But in Buddhism, we don't get anything like that at all. Because that is such an amazing thing for Christianity, or even Hinduism. They really worship you as a saint. But you know, as a Buddhist, I mean, no, it's no personal attainment at all. Just another jhana lobby, that's all. Big deal. I will answer in the way the Buddha would answer. He said, wherever there is the Eightfold Path being practiced, there you will find Sowans, Sakadagamis, Anagamis, and Arahats. Now that is a nice answer. It takes away personalities. And it says, it emphasizes the Course. Wherever there's the Eightfold Path being practiced, there you will find the Aryas, even Arahats as well. Now that's a much better answer. It takes away persons, personalities, attainments, egos and conceit. And instead it says, can you practice the Eightfold Path? If you can, the Buddha says, you will be a Sowan, Sakadagami, Anagami or Arahat sooner or later. That is the promise of the Buddha. Wherever there is a practice of the Eightfold Path, there will be Aryas. So if there's very few Aryas in Sri Lanka, it's because people have not been practicing the Eightfold Path. It's as simple as that. So what haven't you been practicing? What part of the path haven't you been practicing? Jhanas. So thank you very much. Please do not show your gratitude by saying thank you. Show your gratitude by practicing, getting a jhana. When you got a jhana, then you said thank you. Thank you.